Hi everyone, and welcome to the RegTech Report, your update on all things RegTech. My name is Carl Viertel, and with me is Stefan Celestiel. Our mission is to bring you the latest news, speak with industry pioneers, and muse about the latest tech. And we're back. Welcome to episode 14 of the RegTech Report. Hey, Stefan.
14, awesome. Wow. That's a cool number.
Really?
Maybe not. I just wanted to say something funny.
All right, everyone. Well, welcome to a fresh new episode of the RegTech Report.
It's better than 13, you know? Better than 13. Come on.
Today we have, I'd say, a slightly broader theme. We're stretching it a little bit to bring two segments together, but I think it'll be all right. And the broader theme is really talking about RegTech with people who don't know what RegTech is.
Yeah, it is in some ways an obscure topic, and I think that's something that's plagued us our whole careers, because it's not a topic that regular people often get exposed to.
Regular people is a good term for it. So all you irregular people out there, welcome to our podcast. The first segment, we'd like to talk about RegTech versus FinTech. And the reason we'd like to do that is Align was part of the Raconteur publication in the Sunday Times in the UK last weekend. And it was all about the future of FinTech. And sort of Align held up the flag of RegTech. And one of the things that, of course, we wanted to do in that context was actually say, well, why are we relevant in the context of FinTech, but also why are we different?
Yeah, and I think in a lot of ways, the reason for that is because it kind of started in London, and there's a very high FinTech vibe going on there. The FCA moved on this quite a lot, and people associate this with financial regulation in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and rightly so. I mean, one of the themes that we called out there was sort of the looking at a bank from two sides. You have the revenue side and you have the cost side. And most of the FinTech things happen on the revenue side. So how do I make payments even smoother? How do I leverage a banking as a service to form some sort of neobank, right? That's all on the revenue side of banking and focusing on the consumer. And then there's the other side, which is cost. So everything that is required to run a bank, so your IT costs, your physical buildings, and of course your operational costs and costs for dealing with regulation and complying and being a good corporate or banking citizen. And so that's sort of the hook that we use to say, well, you know, this is the difference, this is the big differentiator in RegTech, in that we're actually looking at the cost side. And to a degree, we believe lots of plays that are theoretically possible have played out on the revenue side, on the FinTech side, but on the cost side, on the RegTech side, there's still a lot to be done.
Yeah, and I think that maybe is also the difficult part for people who are not so involved in this topic, because the revenue side, this is usually the customer side, right? This is what you as a person, as a company, know when you're interacting with financial services. The cost side is often hidden unless you work in that industry, and it's how the sausage is made, basically, yeah? Which maybe often you don't even want to know.
Yeah, and sort of the other segue we took in was an example, which is the whole topic around operational resilience, right? Because we said, look, this is something that is very complex. I think we spoke about one aspect which of operational resilience in one of our previous episodes, which is the vendor side and the resilience through vendors. And so the thesis that we put out in the piece was to say, well, the only way that you are going to manage or remain resilient or keep your services resilient is by leveraging RegTech or some sort of technology, because a manual naive approach will not be sufficient to maintain that resilience.
Yeah, and resilience, maybe to just take a step back, is actually an interesting word. Yeah? So this is, in terms of operational resilience, I think this is a newly invented term, maybe a little bit, but it's topics that we had before, like with risk management and BCM, but where resilience also is used quite a lot is in psychology, right? So there's something where a resilient person, you would call somebody who can maintain also a kind of stable emotional situation, even in adverse situations. And if you...
Well, I am a very stable genius.
Yeah, absolutely. Make a line great again. No, I mean, you can if you think about a company or an organization as a person, I mean, that also kind of fits, right? You want to have something that you can survive or even continue to maintain your normal operations or some sort of operations in, let's say, unplanned situations.
Well said. Sort of the third big area that we discussed in the article with Raconteur was also sort of the wider RegTech industry, right? That there are, that it isn't just one-dimensional. There are many different solutions there. It's not a winner-takes-all market. There are going to be multiple players in multiple domains. I mean, a lot of the themes that we've discussed here in the on the podcast quite a bit. I'm not quite sure yet how well it's going to be understood, right? Because it is still an abstract topic, and explaining it to people who have no touch points, no interactions with the typical use cases for RegTech, I don't know if it'll ever be really transparent, regardless of how good the article or how much PR or how much marketing goes out.
Yeah, even people who work in these kind of organizations that have these topics, they might have touch points that are very painful for them. Yes. Keep saying, I guess, in previous episodes. So there's usually a negative connotation also with any kind of regulatory risk and compliance topics. I think that's maybe something we all need to work on in this scene, in this industry, to explain what that means.
Agreed. And look, for all of you listeners out there, check out our blog, blog.align.com. We have a link to the Raconteur edition there. There are a whole bunch of really interesting other articles sort of from the fintech space, so definitely make sure and check that out. And I'd be really, really keen to get your comments and thoughts on how to explain the context of RegTech and the relevance of RegTech for to people who aren't really in the space. Now, the next segment was a result of a conversation that I had, I think, 2 weeks ago. So an investment firm out of New York emailed me saying, oh, we've read about Align, blah, blah, blah. We'd like to talk to you. Can we jump on a call? And so we set up a call, and the analyst I spoke to, we got to talking, and he's like, oh, wait a minute. Are you the guys from that RegTech podcast? And I'm like, yep, that's us. So the fame has reached transatlantic levels. However, and then he said, well, you know, I listened to a few episodes, and, you know, if I were in this space, I think it would be super relevant, but I'm not, so I didn't listen to it. So that got me thinking, well, you kind of are in this space because you are talking, you are an analyst looking to invest in the RegTech space. So this segment is special for all of our investor friends and everyone who might be interested in investing in RegTech. We're going to talk about why you should, why it's relevant, what you need to know, what you should ask, and how you should test if it's for real.
Yeah, and maybe also what are RegTech entrepreneurs looking for in an investor, right?
Exactly.
Maybe we have some tips there.
So you might have a meeting, a regular meeting with the partners of the firm. It might be on Monday. And so someone's pitching, well, I heard about this RegTech, I should invest. So you're a partner at a VC firm. Why should you care about RegTech, Stefan?
So, I mean, it's, I would say, part of the big trend towards enterprise software startups. And that's what we've seen with many VCs, that they're suddenly very interested in that, compared to maybe a couple of years ago where it was more consumer space or SME B2B software. And I think there's been a lot of big numbers being thrown around the RegTech space, so everybody gets their interest in this. So I think that's what's driving this interest. Overall, I would say, why should VC firms or like the partner be actually interested to listen? I mean, what we also keep saying is usually you are dealing with quite experienced people on the other side. Not sure if there's like any RegTech founder that I know that is like fresh out of university or so and then just trying something. You know?
Okay, so your theory is basically an investment in RegTech can be significantly less risky because you're dealing with people who know what they're talking about.
Yeah, maybe the risk aspect is actually an interesting topic because it is in the end always dealing with risk also as a product. So you typically have people think about this quite a lot.
Fair enough. So I also thought about some things that are different when you invest in RegTech versus everything that's going, you know, else going on in your portfolio. So how do you think investing in a RegTech is different, or how will those companies in your portfolio differ?
It's a complicated topic, I would say, and something that where you need to spend time. And that might make it different than maybe some other spaces where you can get the 5-minute pitch and then you know what's going on.
It's pizza delivery meets Uber.
Yeah. And you really need actually also subject matter expertise in that area to be able to, because there's sometimes subtle nuances and it might look the same from the outside, but really to, especially also to see where's the competitive advantage, the defensibility, as our VC friends like to say. What is really, where does that come from? That might not be always super easy or obvious to recognize, but if you've been working in that space, it's easier to see.
No, I agree. And one thing, and another thing that I thought of was sales cycles, right? Yeah. I think that's something that when we speak with our RegTech friends, I think everyone has in common that sales cycles are incredibly long, right? And it's by definition, because the people that buy RegTech software are by definition risk averse, right? That's what they've been hired to do. And so it's never going to be an impulse buy or a quick sell. And I remember the first investors that got on, we had some sort of clause in one of the term sheets around when revenue is recognized for a certain milestone. And and basically we were trying to explain that from someone saying, yep, I think this might be interesting, to actually money hitting our account can just be so incredibly long. In an enterprise, and especially in a RegTech space, there can be months between those two points.
Yeah,
of time.
But I mean, there can be also quite interesting economics, like usually quite potentially quite big deal sizes,
yep.
And also like, maybe upfront cash. That might be different than a traditional SaaS company that maybe just looks at MRR figures or something.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, and that was actually the next thing on my list, which is stickiness, right? Because very few people in a risk area that have really thought of something and have, you know, worked through their use case are going to exchange a RegTech product just on a whim just because, oh, there's something new and shiny, right? I mean, once you've proven value, once you're in a process, I think the churn is actually pretty low. So that actually has a significant impact on the business models.
Yeah, but it really just takes time. And I think that's maybe also a key differentiator, because this is really deep enterprise stuff, and the decision cycles are long, the timing is important, and being at the right place at the right time, and the patience is just required there.
Yep. And I'd say sort of a lot of sales mechanisms that you know from, as you mentioned, sort of simpler B2B plays, smaller enterprise or consumer, they just don't really apply to the type of buyers, to the complexity of the product or the complexity of the processes that a lot of RegTech sales or RegTech companies have. And so, if you approach a deal with a RegTech company from an investment perspective and just expect to be able to replicate a B2C or a simple infrastructure-like SaaS and apply the same metrics and the same approach, I think you will fail.
Yeah, it's not an impulse buy. That's usually you are in some kind of deliberate decision-making process there.
Yeah, so the lovely Bailey also did a lot of research on this, and we actually found a pretty interesting list of the largest RegTech investors. Now, obviously, it's a bit skewed because it's, you know, by the later the deal stage and the bigger the investment, the bigger the ranking in this, which makes sense. But of course, there are naturally then some really big names that have already invested in RegTech. So Bain, Andreessen Horowitz, Accel, Sequoia, but interestingly enough, also Techstars. Mm-hmm. So who are also invested in the line. So well done, Techstars.
Yeah, and if I remember back where we learned the term RegTech was actually when Chris Edelsbach said to us.
Shout out to Chris.
Yeah, hey, Chris, hope you're listening to this. When Chris said, I get it, you're a RegTech. And we said, never heard that, but it sounds about right. It was back in 2015 or something like that.
So now let's flip the coin a little bit. So you're a desperate investor that needs to deploy capital, and you want to be relevant to a RegTech firm. So what do you think, what qualities do you need to bring so that a RegTech will say, yep, let's do a deal?
Mm. So I mentioned already the subject matter expertise. So I mean, being somewhat in that space and like knowing at least, you don't need to be like a super expert or your associates in every topic, but knowing differences between different areas, because risk and compliance is a huge area. And it's different when you're talking to a firm that does some KYC checks compared to somebody who does anti-money laundering.
Yeah,
data analytics. Huh? So it's not the same.
So for me, these conversations, when you know a VC calls and I tell them what we do, it's so much easier if I see that they've you know, have a background in working in a large corporate or an investment bank, and I can say, remember when you were in an investment bank, I'm sure that you had to make sure that you were compliant with XYZ, or you got a messaging from the compliance department, from the security department, or you had to manage operational risk. Right? And just the fact that they know they can, they know the reference, they know sort of what it feels like to be on the receiving end, is incredibly valuable. So if you've never really worked in a corporate, in a bank, or you know, your background is really sort of more sort of mid-tier law firms or just pure M&A work, then the probability of really understanding and knowing the value and being able to evaluate the market fit of a RegTech is going to be a lot more difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, this will also help you in all the stages, right? I mean, this will mean you will know the right people, maybe in your old companies or in your connections, to ask during the due diligence, to help also later with your portfolio companies, to really make sure that also what you're hearing from these founders is not just BS, but it actually is a valid market proposition.
Yeah. Agreed. And yeah, that's actually what I had listed as well, sort of an appreciation for the topic and a powerful network, right? Those are sort of the two last things. Now, let's flip the coin again. You're that analyst that is pitching in a meeting that might happen on Monday when that you're pitching an investment in a certain firm. What are your sort of biggest things that you would look for to know if a RegTech is for real?
Well, I guess as always in the early stage investments, you look at the people, right? The team. And you make sure that these are experienced, knowledgeable people who live through the pain on the front lines. And at the same time embody this. We mentioned before, a lot of people who work in this profession are risk averse. There's a certain percentage that are also willing to take these risks. And I think you need this combination to have a successful entrepreneur in the space. The knowledge about the topic, but also the willingness to do the, like, take the personal risks. And some indication of, like, I don't know, somebody who already quit their job and is working full-time on that topic, for example.
No, agreed. I would add probably if someone claims something reasonably outlandish by enter AI term here.
Yep, that's immediate red flag or something where you really need to pick the whole thing apart, what actually is happening.
Yep. So making sure that it's not actually a Mechanical Turk, that it's not just interns in the background doing the work that the founders are claiming AI does. I think that's sort of your number two indicator you need to go for.
Yeah, and as always, yeah, if you have at least some market validation.
I'd also agree, some revenue.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really the difficult part, because as we mentioned, the long sales cycles, but on the other hand, it's also a sign of the dedication of that team and the, maybe also the strength of the product, that at least you get some first POCs going. And usually, if you have people who have a good combination of skills, like on the tech side, on the sales side, and so on, you will be able to get paid POCs, and you can show some first validation, some first revenues, and so on.
I'd also might add one thing, to that, and I'd say you need at least two sites where they got revenue from, because I have seen some solutions where essentially a solution was built for a very specific customer, mm-hmm. a very specific organization that is then so bespoke to that organization that it's actually not widely applicable across the industry. So I think you have to have two independent sites at least that say, yep, this helps us, this makes sense, this is valid, this adds benefit for us, before I would say, yep, this is worth investing in.
Yep.
So for that, I hope this was a lot more relevant now also for the investment side. I hope there are lots more knowledgeable and smart RegTech investors going forward. I think it is still a really great space to invest in. There's a lot of opportunity going forward. And dear investors, if you're looking for some smart businesses to invest in, contact us. We have a lot of friends. We know a lot of people in the RegTech space that are raising. So get in touch. Cool. Now for our next segment, the news.
The news.
So I always I'm divided by these massive RegTech in air quote investments.
Yeah.
Verafin, that was pretty huge.
Yeah, so like what, 300 million, 300 something million
US? 387 million US.
Yeah.
I mean, the question is are these really RegTechs by definition? I mean, these guys have been around for a while. They're a fraud detection solution.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of also established companies are taking the term, right? And then they are somehow associated with it. But on the other hand, if they're applying smart technology on regulatory problems, why not? Huh?
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, certainly probably one of the biggest deals to date, sort of a PE play. So it's, I guess, not a classic in investment, but it certainly shows movement in the market. And I think there'll be a lot more M&A PE activity sort of in the RegTech space over the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, and there's still, I mean, I think a lot of money lying around. And you see that also if you look outside of the just our little niche. In general, like some of the sizes of some of these investment rounds, this is pretty impressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see how that works with the overall economy and some of the overall startup things that have been happening, but it will stay interesting.
Yeah. So 2 weeks ago, I was in Bonn at BaFin Tech.
Oh yeah, in the old Bundestag. Old Parliament, wasn't it?
Yep. Pretty impressive venue.
Yeah.
So for those of you who don't know the event, so the BaFin is the German financial regulator. This was their third conference on financial technology innovation. So
and us being the super influencers that we are, of course, we're in something like this.
Yeah, so we were certainly there. It's always sort of a good mixture of all sorts of special interest groups, associations, the BaFin themselves, banks, and of course providers of financial technology or RegTech. So always really interesting to listen in and speak. Speak to people in the industry. So the head of BaFin, Felix Hufeld, is a very interesting character. He is very opinionated. I could never claim to have the sort of macro perspective on the on essentially the banking industry as he does, and he's certainly someone who, from both a political and a financial stability perspective, has an enormous wealth and expertise, and he's been in the position for a while. But I'd say maybe I'm out of the loop, or maybe I don't really know or don't share the same insights as he does, but I'd say his view on challenges from a technology perspective seemed to vastly differ from mine.
So what was the number one topic everybody was talking about?
So there was a state secretary there and loads of people. And the main topic was, how do I regulate crypto tokens and how do I fold it into existing legislation?
Mm-hmm.
And I get the point. It's, a better way to invest and pour more money into young organizations and all the rest of it. But it's like, overall, is that really the leading and driving concern in technology today? And
it's a bit over the hype cycle, in my feeling. I mean, we've been saying that for a while, but I had the feeling also when I'm at these meetings where some like regulators are there, it keeps dominating their conversations, yeah? And I don't quite understand why.
I mean, one of the things that one of the secretaries there had mentioned, which I thought was really interesting, is that they said that or banks Brexiting to Frankfurt is not as important for the financial might of the German financial sector than investing into fintech and driving fintech. All right, so I mean that was a pretty strong statement from, you know, pretty high up in German politics, saying, you know, yes, banks are cool, but the financial might of the system can also come from fintech, and making it easier to invest into technology companies can drive that forward. So that was sort of one of the more interesting quotes that I took away. And then, well, there was a lot of bashing of Libra.
When is that actually coming out? I don't know. I subscribed to the newsletter, but didn't read it.
Yeah, so one quote was, it remains the privilege of a sovereign nation to emit currency. Basically, Facebook was attacking the, sovereign state of Germany. I don't know. It seemed all very
It's interesting how long it took to maybe get that message, because the first time I heard about Bitcoin, many, 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 many years ago, this was like the talk of all the nerds. We will revolutionize the system. Fight the power. I thought, interesting, I'll try it out, and I bought 5 Bitcoin for 100 euro. Think about that.
Well, there's a whole nother story. We'll get into that in some other podcast. And then a little bit of news from our own perspective. Stefan, tell our listeners about the upcoming event.
Oh, yeah. They're talking about fintech, regtech events. We're actually cooperating with KPMG Germany. And we will do a regtech event, also in my little side hobby, having founded the International Regtech Association with the German chapter. We're also coordinating there. So this will be October 15th. There's a sign-up link also, I think, also somewhere on our blog.
Just Google a line, KPMG RegTech event, 15th of October in Frankfurt, the KPMG office.
Yeah. It's also an opportunity if you want to meet me in person. Yeah, I'll be there, because I'll be on a panel.
Now, if that doesn't draw the crowds, I don't know what
will. Yeah, maybe I can give some autographs, but only if it does.
You need to do a selfie line like Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, yeah, right.
Now, for the top three this week.
Hey. Oh.
Top three.
It's the
top three.
A jingle, though.
Now, we wanted to do a top three to follow on to our second segment with the investors. Now, when we raised our seed round, we had read somewhere that you probably need about 40 to 50 conversations with different investors to close a seed round. And I was naive / a tiny bit arrogant probably, and it's like, no, we'll, you know, a couple conversations, it'll be sorted. And we ended up creating like a folder for each, you know, new firm that we talked to. And I think at the point when we were sort of signing the papers, I saw it was like folder 43 or something. I was like, God damn it, they were right.
Yeah, I mean, so, a lot of these experience on the way of entrepreneurship can be humbling. And this is, I guess, a part of it. We just learn about this.
However, we do get a fairly large set of data points when speaking to different investors. And so today we are going to do the top three things that every investor says.
Yeah.
Do you want to start?
Yeah, let me start. So imagine you're at some conference, and then this fresh young VC associate comes along rocking.
Is he wearing a vest?
Yeah, Patagonia vest and Allbirds sneakers, of course. the VC clothing kit. And you have a chat, and then one of the things that will inevitably come out is, you know, we're different. We are smart money. And one of the reasons we're smart money, we will help you along the way because we have so many great connections, like into industry, into corporates and so on, This will, you know, this will completely, it's even better than the millions we're pumping into your business. This will like bring you millions of revenue on day one.
And everyone says we're different than everyone else because of exactly that. Yeah. So sorry, guys, you're not.
We're different in exactly the same way, like the hipsters. So.
Also, so my number three is a VC will never say no.
Yeah.
So it's always, oh, you're a bit too early, you're a bit too late, yeah. But we would love to keep in touch.
Yeah, let's talk. So let's talk again like next month, you know, and see where your numbers are.
So it's all about gathering data and data points, and so there's never a no. There's always a, oh, you just don't fit our stage perfectly. So that's my number three.
Yeah,
your number two, Stefan.
My number two is so you had one of these meetings, and then you get this answer like, yeah, let's talk again next month. So again, have a meeting next month, maybe even with a partner now or something like that. Or it could be exactly the same people as the meeting before last month. And then they'll basically be, can you just, you know, repeat your pitch and just start from the beginning?
Because we forgot everything.
Well, they wouldn't say that, of course, but it's the fact. Yeah. I mean, that happens quite a lot. And it's also an indicator of somebody who's not like super deep into the subject matter. Because then, of course, as we mentioned before, this is difficult sometimes to grasp the differences, and they might see 1,000 pitch decks in a year or whatever, which I understand then it's difficult to keep track of, yeah, but it might not be the best match then also if somebody's not as interested in like kind of remembering what you guys talked about a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, so my number two is, we're just closing a fund. We almost have it closed. We almost have it closed, and you would be perfect for that. I'm sure we'll have it closed in the next 3 months.
Yeah, and then we're ready to go. But let's prepare everything now, you know.
So there's always the next fund being closed, and it's going to be hundreds of millions. We basically have we have it all together. We're just now closing, and I think it's the same on the startup side. Oh, we've almost have our Series A closed. Yeah. We're oversubscribed. it's the same bullshit for both sides.
And it's they're in that way in the same situation, right? Because they also need to invest, get investors, their limited partners, and it is the reality that they're always driven to show the results and their numbers so they can go to the next fund.
Oh yeah, it's a chicken and the egg problem, just like with startups.
But and it's actually also something to check, right? If somebody or like some firm already did multiple funds, and that's an indicator of success, right? Because a lot are struggled to after the first one they raised to go to get the next one going.
All right, your number one.
My number one is
that investors always say.
So. Usually what you will get at the end of a meeting is, okay, I'll get back to you sometime after Monday, because they all have their Monday meetings, the infamous Monday meetings.
Yep. I actually had one exception. I had it on Fridays, but it's globally harmonized a meeting on Monday.
it must be somewhere in the rule book. I don't know.
So number one thing of that investors always say is, oh, we only invest in teams. Well, yes, but you also invest in the technology, you invest in the execution, you invest in the numbers, you invest in the revenue, or else you wouldn't want data rooms. If you only invested in teams, then you could give a CV, a warm handshake, and you would invest, which is fair enough, right? I wouldn't invest just in someone's face or whatever, but I also might not say I only invest in teams all the time.
I mean, in the end, also it comes down to, as an investor, if I take that head, do you believe in that thing, whatever you're investing in, being successful? It's the same if you buy shares from a large company. So in the end, you want to have that feeling, and maybe often in the beginning already there's some kind of indication, and then you try to rationalize also your decision making by looking at the numbers and so on, and de-risking the whole thing. I totally agree. It is the full picture usually that everybody is looking at.
I mean, that being said, obviously this is all tongue in cheek, and it's always fun to poke fun at an industry or so. But what I will say is, there is a huge amount of money going into VC and PE at the moment, right? And it's forcing investors to actually really think about how they want to invest, how to specialize, how to be most relevant. And, you know, obviously not for altruistic reasons, but because they want to make good investments and good returns on their fund. But I think it's it is creating a lot of innovation. And the conversations that I've had with a lot of analysts and partners at firms of late has really shown that, you know, there's a lot of smarts being put into it. It's not just, you know, money being fired into the market at random. So overall, I still am very optimistic of especially VC investment in the RegTech space.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of people have already listened to this advice we're giving today before the fact that it actually moved in that direction.
Yeah. With that, thank you so much for listening. Have a great autumn, and we'll be back with you hopefully in 2 weeks. I'm going to be working in our Melbourne office, so maybe we'll do a virtual call-in session together.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Take care, everyone. Bye. Thanks for listening. Let's continue the conversation on Twitter. Follow our dedicated podcast handle, @TheRegTechRep. Make sure to rate this podcast and send your thoughts and comments to TheRegTechReport@Align.com. Once again, that's TheRegTechReport@Align.com. You can also follow Align on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Twitter, or catch up on our podcasts on Align.com/TheRegTechReport.